originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I am joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, new channel XM 201, and also to those of you tuning in to our website at www.horseracingradio.net. So a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF is an organization that is very near and dear to my heart. They provide financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. And if you are able to help, I encourage you to visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest tonight, he started out riding bulls, but ended up on horseback riding thoroughbreds. He's a familiar face riding at the Chicago circuit, having won 7 leading rider titles at Hawthorne Racetrack, 1 at Arlington, and also he won 1 leading rider title at Delta Downs as well. He was also just the 5th jockey ever to have won 1,000 races at Arlington Park. He has a total number of 3,839 wins and over $76 million in earnings. It is a pleasure to introduce jockey Chris Amey. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here, Chris, and I can't wait to hear your story. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now. You're currently riding at Hawthorne.
Yes, the Hawthorne meet just started last weekend. We had a 2-day weekend. So we're just getting started back at Chicago Racing for the year.
And how's that meet going for you so far, Chris?
Well, I got a couple seconds and thirds opening weekend. Didn't get any on the win end, but this weekend coming up, I think it's going to be a little different.
Good deal. We'll be watching and rooting you on, Chris. And I hope the weather up there in Chicago has warmed up a bit.
It's not too bad. It's a little cool and a little rainy today, but I think by the weekend it's going to be okay for racing.
So Chicago's pretty much home for you now, and how do you like the area and riding the circuit?
Yes, I love Chicago. I moved here 20 years ago, basically, after I had my first child, and I didn't want to, I hated moving all over the country, following horses. So Chicago back then had 3 racetracks in one area so I could put my kids in school and do my dream job and not have to move everywhere. They could have a good family setting.
Yeah, that makes sense. And most jockeys do have that nomadic lifestyle, so I can see how staying at one circuit would be appealing. And tell us about your family. You have a couple kids?
Yes, I have a couple kids. They're grown now. Hunter's 22. And my daughter's 19. So, and they're doing great.
Do they have any interest in the racing industry?
Well, yeah. My son, he's more into basketball. He's a basketball coach, and he works at the feed store. So he still, works with horsemen because he delivers horse feed. So that was kind of funny. And then my daughter is very much into horses, and she's going to a community college, Blackhawks. And they it's basically a horse college. They bring her horses, and she rides her horses every day, and she takes her college classes.
Nice. And what does she plan to do with that? Does she have any aspirations to be a jockey like you?
Well, you know, since she's been a little baby, she's always talked about being a jockey. But I don't know. Right now, she could be pre-vet. You know, she's taking animal science, could be jockey. I'm not pushing her to do. She's just enjoying right now riding her horses and learning.
That's great, Chris. And you mentioned your son's a basketball coach. I'm assuming you never played basketball when you were a kid.
No, I'm not too good at it, but he did growing up, and he's the same size as me, but he's really good in playing basketball, and he's really good at teaching kids. He loves teaching the youth, and he teaches 7th grade middle school assistant coach, and he also has the 8th grade A-team for the Cager League.
Nice. Well, let's talk about when you were a kid, Chris. Were you very athletic? Obviously, you weren't very tall to be a basketball player, but did you play a lot of sports growing up?
We always wanted to, and our parents wouldn't let us. They just didn't want us to get hurt. But after Mom and Dad got divorced, that was like we were pretty young. In about 7th grade, we ended up moving in with a horse trainer who was the school bus driver, and we start doing the rodeo circuit. So kind of they didn't want us to do sports, but then we end up doing rodeo. Probably more dangerous.
I would think so, definitely. And I find that very intriguing, and obviously you love that adrenaline. What was it like riding bulls? Obviously, when you're riding the rodeo circuit, you know you're going to come off eventually. So what was that like?
It's more like an adrenaline rush, and you kind of get addicted to it, and you can't stop. But it is, I would say 8 seconds on a bull feels longer than a six furlong race on a racehorse sometimes. It's just amazing how the time slows down when something's trying to basically kill you underneath you.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, I do like riding mechanical bulls, but I'm sure that's nothing like riding a real live bull. And what's the trick? What's the trick to staying on for 8 seconds?
It takes a lot of practice. There's different techniques. I used to watch bull riding tapes and bull riding schools. But my first dream was to be a bull riding champion. But my legs weren't quite strong enough. I couldn't quite, you know, good enough at it. And actually, one of our friends became the world champion, Mike White. We grew up with him he worked at the horse farm with us too.
So then eventually the horses became appealing to you. You said you lived with a horse trainer. So tell us how that all started.
Well, then our middle school school bus driver happened to be a horse trainer. And I'm a twin. My twin brother started going to the horse farm with him because he thought he was small to get on some of the horses. And then I ended up being just a little tag along because you know, my mom calls like, you know, Chris has nothing to do. So I started cleaning, you know, stalls and grooming horses in about the 7th grade. And we end up moving in with the horse trainer because he kind of started taking care of us. And that's kind of how it all started, just from the school bus driver.
And where was this? Was this in Louisiana, or I know you were born in Virginia?
Yeah. Yes, this was Louisiana. My dad, we moved down from Pennsylvania during the oil boom. My dad worked on the mechanical engineer on the oil rigs in Louisiana. So that's why we moved down here. And so I grew up in Louisiana. A lot of people think I'm Cajun just because I've been here so long, you know, grew up there. But actually, I was born in Virginia. So.
Well, but so many great riders came from Cajun country. So I'm sure that was around you most of the time, especially the horse trainer you grew up with. And were you close to a racetrack? Did you live close to somewhere?
Yeah, we wasn't very, like 30 minutes from Delta Downs. And I took care of the horses, but I was doing the rodeo trying to be the big-time bull rider. And after high school, my brother started riding during high school. And he was making money driving trucks, and I'm trying to do the bull riding thing. And if you get bucked off, you don't make any money. And after high school, I was like, you know what? If I just want to ride a race for fun, if I get bucked off, they're still going to pay me. So I thought that was pretty cool. So I started riding races, and I figured I'll just do it till I get hurt, you know, just for fun. And now it's been, 28 years later, I'm still doing it.
You still love it?
Still love it. I think it is so cool, and it's so amazing. And I've always been a horse freak. I always had horse posters growing up as a little kid. And it's just amazing that I can just go out there and ride horses, and then they're going to pay me. So I think it's cool. And it's a rush, too. You get to go very fast. And not like bull riding, but it's still a rush.
Well, tell us about your twin brother, Aaron. It's really funny to me because I got your phone number from Joel Campbell. We had on the show a couple of weeks back. Of course, also had his twin brother, Jesse, on the show about, a year or so ago. And
they're good friends of mine.
Yeah, of course. Of course. So what was it like growing up with a twin brother?
We were very competitive. So, I think that started keeps us both competitive, and that's why we're good in sports. We have that competitive against each other our whole life, growing up. So I think that helps in any sport, and we're kind of used to it.
So did that competitive nature kick in when you saw your brother riding and you wanted to be good like him? You actually probably wanted to beat him, right?
Yes, for sure. And then when I started, I got lucky. I started doing really good, and he rode. He mostly stayed at the Delta area riding thoroughbreds during the one meet. When they had the next meet during quarter horses, he would ride quarter horses. I wanted to follow the thoroughbreds. I didn't think the quarter horses was that fun because they're over in 20 seconds. I like to strategize, figure out how I'm going to win. I kind of like that part of the game. So I kind of followed the thoroughbreds to Evangeline and Delta for about 5 years, and then decided to go to New Orleans, the fairgrounds, and Louisiana down circuit for about three before I head out to Chicago then.
Does your brother still ride?
No, he ended up retiring, I think, in 99. And then he was a steward, actually, at Delta Downs for a while. And he kind of got tired of that. Now he works at the chemical plant down there in Louisiana. They call it Chemical Alley down there. There's plants everywhere, chemical plants. And he works down there and got a real job, and he's happy.
Does he still follow your career?
I don't know if he follows it a whole lot, but, yeah, he does. You know, he checks on Facebook, sees him winning, tells me congratulations. And he's got five kids now, so he stays pretty busy. He can't look too often. You don't have too much time.
Yeah, I would say so. With five kids, for sure. And you mentioned that he rode quarter horses, Chris, and I want to talk about that for just a second. I never actually rode a quarter horse in a race, but worked a couple from the gate, and that's a rush, the way they break out of there. Did you ride a couple quarter horse races? And then you obviously mentioned you decided to stick with thoroughbreds, but what was that
like? I rode a bunch of 870s and 770 races. That was quarter horses and thoroughbreds, and that was kind of dangerous. But I only rode two straightaway races. Yes, the power is amazing. It's unbelievable. They duck faster, flip faster, dump you faster. Everything's faster. But it's if you don't break well, it's like the race is over. It's more like a drag race. I kind of like I said, sit behind, figure out where I'm going to go. I kind of like that part of the game better. So it didn't appeal to me at all, though.
Would you describe that as your riding style? More of a come from behind rider and strategize where to place yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I always chip handicap. I always try to figure out who I got to beat, where everybody's going to be. That way I can kind of visualize the race, running in my mind. And a lot of times it doesn't happen like you think it's going to happen, but when it does, it's like I already run the race in my head 5 or 6 times, so I know what's happening. So that's why sometimes it works out so good. But then other times, you think you're going to be in the lead and you're behind. Sometimes they're animals, so they don't always cooperate with what you think will happen looking at the racing form.
Yeah, that is definitely true. It doesn't always work out to plan, but how would you describe yourself in those early days when you were an apprentice, did it come pretty easily to you, or did you struggle with a couple things? Did you have any mentors in the room?
Well, it didn't come easy to me. I don't think I was a natural jockey, but I just said it was very competitive, and I just kept trying to learn something new every day. And I still, to this day, I remember telling myself in 10 years, I'll be the best rider I can be. And when I got to that 10-year mark, I said, you know what, it's going to take another 10 years. And I just keep thinking that I just have a lot to learn every day, try to get better. Once you think you know it all, I think that's when you start your, you know, descent down the valley. I mean, once you hit your peak, you got to keep going.
Yeah, there's always something new to learn, definitely. And how was it like in the room for you in those early days? Did you have anyone take you under their wing?
No, I don't really think no one took me under their wing. I kind of just watched the Cajun riders back then were just amazing. I mean, down there I was having a ride against Robbie Alvarado, and this is at Delta Downs when I started. Eddie Martin, Kurt Bork, James Avan. I mean, this was a little track. Our allowance races were 2,200 for allowance races. Our stakes were 7,500, and they had some of the best riders in the country riding there, really. Because them guys are really good, them Cajun riders.
Wow, 7,500 for a stakes race. That's pretty crazy to think about.
Back then, we had one big race. The Jean Lafitte was $100,000, two-year-old race. And it was a trial. You had to run trials to get in the race. So you couldn't even, it's not like you just entered the 100,000. You had to run like 10 trials and hope you got in the big race. I mean, that was our only big race of the year at Delta Downs.
Wow. And Delta's a bull ring, right?
Yes.
So that had to be, I would imagine, starting out at a place like that. First of all, it's a great educational opportunity, but I would think that would be a really tough place to start out.
Yeah, I think it was tough, but I mean, that's how, you know, you learn. You learn by riding with good riders, because, you know, you end up where you're at in any sport. Whatever your level you're playing at is the level you become. So you want to keep learning and get better. You got to go against, you know, keep moving up against better riders.
Did you find that riding at the bull ring taught you how to get a horse out of the gate?
I think it was more Lloyd Romero. He was one of my trainers that took me under his wing, Randy Romero's dad, and he used to get on my butt if I wasn't first out of the gate. So that kind of made me learn to get out of the gate or I'm going to get yelled at. But I don't know I haven't ridden the bull ring a long time. I kind of like the longer stretches now, so I don't know if I'd be as good at the bull ring as I used to be. But when I started, that's all I knew, so I had to get used to it quick.
Yeah, it can be tough. I rode at Charlestown, and it's a different beast, you know. But
you kind of get used to it. You know, if you're driving the bull rings a lot, you get used to it, and then when you ride long stretches, you get used to it. So. So I think sometimes it's better to ride a jock when people ship in their good horses at that track, using them kind of bull rings or vice versa, a long stretch, because you don't want to make your move too early or too late, depending on the track that you're used to.
Yeah, it's totally different riding at a bull ring. And was there anyone at that time that you would watch? Say you mentioned Robbie Alvarado, you mentioned you rode for Randy Romero's dad. Did you watch Randy Romero himself ride? Did you watch any of those other great riders? And did you try to copy their style? Did you try to look like them on a horse?
I would try to watch, like Kurt Bork, Robbie Alvarado. They were very good riders. I'd kind of watch them ride. But I know when I started, I had someone gave me a VHS tape of Santa Anita. And it was like 8 hours of just replays. And I would just watch that tape and watch, Corey Nakatani, Eddie Delahousse, Chris McCarron, all them guys that rode out of Santa Anita back then in the, early 90s and late 80s, and just watch all them legends that used to be out there at Sandy. And so I just watch some old replays over and over, just trying to, you know, see what they're doing and how they ride, and just trying to figure it out myself, basically.
How tall are you?
I'm 5'5".
Yeah, I thought you were on the taller end for a jockey. I'm 5'6 myself. Did you find it was more difficult to look pretty on a horse to fold up?
I don't know. It seems like the tall jockeys that are a lot taller than me, they can get even flatter. So I think it's sometimes easier for a taller jockey. I don't know. I feel like I'm average size, the 5'5", 5'6".
Yeah.
I mean, they got some shorter, but they got some a lot taller than me too.
So that wasn't obviously something you struggled with, but was there anything that you had a harder time learning in those early days?
Harder time learning?
Yeah.
I think everything just takes practice. I mean, switching sticks used to be hard, and now I think probably one of the fastest stick switcher in the country. And, you know, trying to figure out when to go, when not to go. I mean, there's a lot of things that just takes practice and a lot of, you know, races. That's why you have the apprentice for a year, because it just takes a long time to get really good at it and figure it all out.
Jockey Chris Amey joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Chris, how did your apprentice year go for you?
I went really well. I think I went 190 or something. I'm just guessing, though. I haven't really looked a long time.
So you did really well. And did you stay at the Delta circuit there? You stay at Delta Downs for a while, or what was that circuit like? Did you move around?
Yeah, I started off at Delta, and so I just rode at Delta and the Evangeline circuit, that little circuit there, kind of. And for like 5 years, and I just figured that, to me, that was like the ultimate. I couldn't believe I was doing it. So the first 5 years, that was it. And then I decided, you know what, hey, I don't know if I'm good enough, but let's go try, you know, some bigger track, see what happens.
And you mentioned you went to Fairgrounds then, and what was it like when you arrived there?
My first weekend there, no one knew who I was, and I went 9 opening weekend. And they were I remember the reporters had like 5 or 6 following me around, like, who the heck is this guy from Delta Down? I just riding little trainers that are shipping in from Delta, and I just got lucky that opening week. So I didn't end up making leading rider. I finished 3rd. They had Ronald Artland got leading rider. He was like the king of Louisiana. And Robbie Alvarado ended up getting 2nd, so I finished 3rd. So that was my first meet there. So started off pretty good.
Yeah, I'd say so. To start right off, you know, 3rd in the standings, that's very impressive. How long did you stay there?
I ended up riding like the Louisiana Downs and Fairgrounds circuit for about 3 years. And like I said, that's when I had my son, Hunter. And I was tired of moving every 6 months, because you got to pack everything up, move, you know, to Shreveport and move back to New Orleans. And I thought maybe I can buy a house in Chicago, live in one house, and just ride all year.
And are you married, Chris?
No, I'm divorced now. I got divorced a few years ago.
So then you decided for your family you wanted to move to Chicago. And did you have anyone backing you? Did you have any trainers going up there that you knew, or an agent already established up there?
No, I didn't have any trainers. A lot of people told me I was crazy for going to Chicago. that you know, that colony kind of has it wrapped up there. They had, you know, Mark Guidry, Ray Seville, Carlos Silva. There was a lot of early fires, a lot of big riders up here. But I had Robbie Alvarado contacted an agent for me, and he told him, hey, I think this guy, you know, he tries hard, young guy, he's pretty good. So Robbie Alvarado helped set up an agent with me, and then ended up taking off from there.
Who was that agent?
Jay Fedor.
Is he still your agent now?
No, he's not my agent now, but I had him for might be 15 years, something like that.
Wow. That's a long relationship with an agent. You see, you know, jockeys and agents go different ways pretty frequently.
Yep.
So that's a good long relationship with one particular agent. And tell us, Chris, tell the audience, what, in your opinion, makes a good agent?
I mean, someone who, of course, you have to be a good talker. You have to be a people person. And you know, I think the main thing is it's hard when you're in demand to keep everyone happy. And so if you got an agent that can keep everyone happy and kind of know where everyone's going and, you know, basically don't get anyone mad at you so you can ride them back. Because, you know, everything comes full circle. You don't want to burn any bridges. And I think that makes a good agent.
And do you feel that it's really important for you as a jockey to work really hard in the mornings to be willing to go out every day and work horses no matter, you know, what day of the week it is?
Especially starting off, I mean, that's the only way you're going to get into the business. I mean, you got so many riders, I mean, 1,000 riders, and, you know, you might have 30 on track. You got to try to outwork everybody. And I'd say the first, through my 20s and 30s, I mean, I almost didn't miss any day. You know, now I'm a little older, so I don't go out as much. I'm kind of more, I mean, I'm established. If they don't know who I am by now, they're never going to know.
Right.
I figured. But I definitely worked very, very hard, you know, a lot of mornings, a lot of work. Unless you're one of those lucky, special people that, you know, everybody wants you, you don't have to do much most of the time. If you're like me, I had to work my way up to the top because nothing was given to me. So,
did you find that when you arrived to Chicago, it was a similar way as when you arrived in Fairgrounds? Did you start right off winning, or did it take some time?
I did. Well, I got lucky right off the bat when I got there in 1996. That Mark Guidry, one of the top riders of all time, really, he took off in the Hawthorne Gold Cup horse, and there was no one to ride him, and no one knew I was, and they put me on a real come on flip for Mickey Goldfine. For some reason, he decided to ride the new guy coming in town, and I ended up winning the Hawthorne Gold Cup on Mark Guidry's second call. So that kind of helped me get going, but I had to, it took a almost every day of working every morning to about 4 years. So I really, that's when I took off in 2000. A lot of the guys retired or they left. And in 2000, when that next decade, I really took over Chicago racing.
Come on, Flip was your first graded stakes victory in 1996 in the Hawthorne Gold Cup. We're going to hear a replay of one of your great victories aboard Sierra Sunset in the Rebel Stakes. Right after this short commercial break, folks, stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. Jose Ortiz ranked second in North American earnings last week by finishing second in the Florida Derby with Hoffberg, second in the Gulfstream Park Oaks with Take Charge Paula, and winning the Grade 3 Honey Fox with Lowell. Ortiz finished the week with 4 wins, 9 seconds, and 1 third place finish. John Velasquez had a great week as he led North American earnings by winning the Soaring Softly with Somersault in the Grade 1 Florida Derby with Audible. Johnny V finished the week in the money on 71% of his mounts from 7 wins, 3 seconds, and 2 third place finishes. Finally, the Foundation Detox Jockey of the Week, Luis Saez, notched back-to-back jockey titles at Gulfstream by setting a record for most winners during the championship meet with 137. Saez's record-setting meet was highlighted by a 6-win day and 2 7-win days. Saez won 36% of his mounts from 12 wins, 2 seconds, and 4 third place finishes. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all of the latest news in the jockey world, visit jockeytalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
And here they come into the stretch of the Rebel. Sierra Sunset is showing the way. Sacred Journey second. Middle of the track is Z Fortune along with Isabel. They drive for the wire. The leader is Sierra Sunset. Isabel running second. And down the outside, it's the other Steve Aspenson horse, King Silver Sun and Sean Bridgemahan, making an effort, but he can't get to Sierra Sunset. It's Sierra Sunset who is going to be clear and win the Rebel by 3.5. King Silver Sun second, Isabel third, Golden Yank was fourth, followed by Z Fortune in fifth after a mile and a 16th, a minute 43.4.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigle, and I am joined tonight by jockey Chris Amy. Chris, we just heard the replay of your victory aboard Sierra Sunset in the 2000 Grade 2 Rebel Stakes. Tell us about that race. Do you remember that race?
Yes, that was so exciting. I don't know how I ended up picking up that horse. I think Luis Quinones had a double call, but I picked up that horse, and that's the Oaklawn has a trio of races. It's a, you know, stepping stone to the Kentucky Derby to win the basically second leg of it, the Grade 2 Rebel, to go on to the Arkansas Derby. It was amazing, and I was so excited.
How did the race play out?
I ended up going. I was up on the lead, and I stayed. I remember him. He wanted me out in the middle of the racetrack, stay wide. I think the track was kind of bad on the inside that day, and he wants to keep him out. So I did. So I kind of stayed wide the whole race, but it ended up working. The horse just kept going, and that was my first time on him, and he just ran the monster race, and I really couldn't believe I won it when I did.
Did you already have a relationship with the connections? You mentioned you're not even quite sure how you got the mount, but did you already know?
No, never heard of him, never met him.
Were you riding at Oaklawn Park at the time?
Yes, I was. I've rode off and on to Oaklawn because we, you know, Chicago Racing shuts down for a few months, so I went to Oaklawn many times just to kind of pass the winter time till, you know, the Chicago Racing started back up.
When I'm looking at Sierra Sunset's past performances now, and as you mentioned, the Rebel Stakes is stepping stone to the Kentucky Derby. Unfortunately, we never saw that horse. Never ended up running in the Derby.
No, he ended up, during training, he ended up, before the Arkansas Derby, he injured his ankle. Mm. So that kind of ended his career and my Kentucky Derby dreams. Wow. But, you know, those things happen sometimes.
Yeah, this is definitely true. Have you ever ridden in the Derby, Chris?
No, I've got close a few times. I had one for Steve Asmussen. I finished second in the Illinois Derby. And he was like 28th on the list. As you know, they take 20. And they kept having scratches, and I got down to 21st on the list. And I was like, one more scratch. I get in the Kentucky Derby. And unfortunately, there was no more scratches. So I finished 21st on the list. So close.
Oh, my gosh. That's brutal. Wow.
I know.
Oh, my goodness. But you still have – is that still a goal of yours to one day ride in the Kentucky Derby?
Yes. I would like to do it. I mean, just because most people don't know anything about horse racing, the first thing they ask you is, well, have you rode in the Kentucky Derby? So, of course, one day I want to be able to tell them, yes, I have. You know, it's just hard when you stay in Chicago all year. It's hard to pick up a national horse that good. You almost have to follow the horses all over the country. And like I said, I kind of want to raise my family and do both. So Chicago has been a little hard. Unless that horse ends up at Chicago and you're a lucky guy to be on it, you're not going to make the Derby. So it's a lot of luck. But, yes, I would like to make it one day.
You're exactly right. I don't know how many, plane rides I've been on with a person sitting next to me. You know, you have a conversation, and that is the first question they have. You ever ridden in the Derby? Everyone wants to say they have, but
they can't even when you try to tell them all states, not all states, but a lot of states have their own Derby, and they like, really? I thought it was only Kentucky Derby. There's a Louisiana Derby, there's an Iowa Derby, Illinois Derby.
It's true. It's very true. Now, Chris, tell us though. I'm looking at your many, many graded stakes victories here, and you have a long list. So tell us, what would the highlight reel of your career consist of? Some of your favorite horses, some of your favorite victories.
Of course, the Rebel, I mean, I think that's probably my most prestigious and biggest win, but the Hawthorne Gold Cup on Come On Flip. And the Modesty Handicap on Wade for me was a big, exciting win for, you know, Harvey Veneer Stable. And I loved that horse, Wade for me. And there's so many. It's just all of them winning those big races makes it exciting. I mean, the Hanson Cup, I went on 15 rounds, but I got disqualified for impeding the progress of another horse. And so I ended up winning back on Hoagie a few years later. So that was like redemption. So the Hanson Cup was a big win for me, too.
You mentioned Wade for me. You won the 2000 Modesty Handicap with. You said you liked that horse a lot. What was it about that particular horse that did you guys just click, or what was it about him?
Yes. He was just never stopped trying. Go through any hole. I mean, just when you ride a horse that has a lot of talent and it's explode and just run their guts out. I mean, that's just, there's no feeling like it down the lane when you're passing horses and you can feel every muscle, you know, pushing and pulling, and just they have that wanting to win mindset that's just awesome to be on the back of one of those.
Well, riding in the Chicago circuit, Chris, obviously the biggest race there would be the Arlington Million. And
Yes. If
my statistics are correct here, you've ridden in that at least twice. Am I correct?
Yes, I did. I rode Proceed B in 1 year, and he was on the lead for most of the way and ended up fading. But I did ride not too long ago for what was his name? Kind of caught me off guard. Copper, Shining Copper.
Yes, yeah, that's the horse. It was for
Chad Brown, and I was supposed to be the rabbit, like 99-1, for their other horse, was Blue Kitten. We wanted the Blue Kitten to win. I set the pace, and I almost held on. I ended up running third. I mean, that was very exciting for me. The horse run huge, and the pizza man ended up beating me right at the end, and Blue's Kitten got second, but my entry mate. But I ended up in third, so I was, like, so close. So that was almost, I mean, that could have been a big turning point in my career, too. Who knows, if you win a million, you can go on to bigger and better things.
Yeah, I remember watching that race, and like you said, that horse held on. So if I remember right, you only got beat maybe a length, if that. And
yeah,
and like you said,
I think it went like the fastest half in million history.
Wow.
They said, but that was supposed to be the rabbit. Everyone knew it was going to be a rabbit, so I don't know how that helped. But just keep a fast pace, and you know. And they said, if you can win, win it. But, you know, we just need a fast pace. So that was my job. And so I did, and almost won. So that was pretty exciting. Because I didn't expect to be riding that race at all. And all of a sudden, they're like, hey, Chad Brown entered three. They need one more rider. And so I got lucky, and someone threw my name in the hat.
So you'd never ridden the horse before, I take it?
No.
Did you
never rode him again either?
You took the question out of my mouth. That's a shame.
They were shipping him for that day, so I got paid to ride him for third. I mean, I got $5,000 for third, so I'm not complaining.
Worked out well. You obviously fit the horse pretty well. And you mentioned your other mount in the Arlington Million, Proceed B, who you actually won the Hawthorne Derby with in 2009. And tell me again where you two ended up in that year's Arlington Million.
We faded to the back. We were in the lead, like to a turn of a home, and then he was just out of his league. They overpowered me, and then you're running against some of the best horses in the world. So he tried hard. It's just he wasn't that type of horse, but we gave him a chance. And it was always exciting to be in the Arlington Million. I mean, that's the biggest race in Chicago, and it's, you know, a lot of parties, a lot of get-togethers for that, a lot of hype, and it's people from all over the world come in that day. So to be able to be a part of that is one of the highlights of my career too. So I'm just glad that I could, you know, participate.
Chris, tell me, when you're turning for home in the Arlington Million, and obviously it sounds like both times you were riding in the Arlington Million, you were probably in front when you turned for home. A day like that, when the grandstand's just packed, so many people have come out to watch the race, can you hear the crowd cheering for you turning for home?
Well, that's one thing about Arlington Park, just the way it's designed. It's kind of almost like the shape of a C, and it echoes everything at you. I mean, you can feel the wave of energy and sound waves hitting you as you turn for home. It is unbelievable when you have 35,000 people and all that being echoed back at you. I mean, yes, you can feel it. And it is a feeling you can't describe. I mean, you just feel the roar of the crowd, and that makes everything, you know, much more heightened senses, and just everything's more higher energy.
Goosebumps thinking about what a rush that must be, and that has to really even make you want it even that much more to feel the energy from the crowd. And it's interesting,
right,
to hear you say that you can literally feel the sound.
Yes, that's not at every racetrack, and not all the time, but when they have like they say the big races, Arlington Million or stuff like that, and it's so packed and so many people sharing, it's like the waves of sound hitting them. Yeah, you can feel it hitting you. It's like I said, and it's just something you can't describe.
Jockey Chris,
exciting,
Amy.
Exciting if you're in the front.
Yeah, right? Jockey Chris, Amy joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Chris, we talked about your highlights, riding in the Arlington Million, winning the Rebel, winning all of your other graded stakes victories. And now we have to talk about some of the low points in your career. Obviously, I would think this would probably be maybe the lowest, when you actually had a horse jump over the inner rail. You were injured, and then you came right back, and then you had another injury. That had to be really frustrating.
Yeah, that was the worst-case scenario. When the horse, I was getting passed, but I was on the lead, the horse coming by me on the outside. For some reason, my horse ducked, and he jumped into the temporary rail and that rail exploded, because it's made to explode so you don't get impaled or injure the horse. But it also tripped the horse, and I happened to just land in the grass, but as I fell, the fence fell, and I landed on top of the fence, and it shattered my foot, all my toes, broke my thumb, cut my eye. I had like 15 stitches across my eye, knocked me out. It was pretty rough. Horse was okay. He did cut himself, but he ended up being okay. And yes, it's 2 months of hard therapy coming back, and then I win my second race back. I was so excited. I only had my cast off like for a week because I was so excited to get back racing. And then the third race, the horse injuring himself and fell, and I broke my wrist. So I was out another 2 months. So that was hard to deal with psychologically.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I can't imagine. You think you're on top of the world, you come back, you win your, you know, first race back, and then immediately after that, another injury. And you mentioned the psychological aspect of that, and I can't stress enough how that's probably the most difficult part of being injured, where when you're a jockey, and when I would have injuries and I was on the shelf, it was just so frustrating not to be riding. And I can't imagine how you felt whenever you think you're back and then you have to stay out a while to recover again.
Yeah, because I mean, your bills still keep coming in. People don't realize that they don't pay you much money. You just get a few hundred dollars, you know, a week. And then, like you said, it takes so – once you lose your business, it's competitive sport. I mean, once you're out of the business for a couple of months, you have to basically try to earn it all back. And then when you're out again for another 2 months, it's like you completely just lost everything. Everyone replaces you fast in this business, and any business or sport. So you have to be able to keep your head on straight, keep positive, and just work your way back up.
Was it difficult for you coming back that second time? Was it hard to regain all of that lost business?
Well, it's something you got to put in your back of your head. You know, I just, hey, this happened. There's nothing I can do about it. You know, I'm just going to do my thing, and whatever happens, happens. I mean, it is what it is. And of course, you don't want it to happen again, but you know, this, we're in a business that is very dangerous. And when the good is good, it's unbelievable. When it's bad, it can be bad. So you take the good with the bad and just go with the flow.
How do you prepare yourself for those possible injuries as a rider? Obviously, we're self-employed contractors. We're not making money when we're not riding, and especially, you know, not making good money when you're not winning, of course. And so how do you prepare for these scenarios financially? I mean, that has to be really tough.
That's why you should always, you know, they say save for a rainy day. You should have at least a couple of months saved that you can pay, you know, your bills and get by on, and, you know, have the Jockey Guild help you out. And track insurance gives you a couple hundred a week, so you just have to be, you know, that's part of the game. That's how I see it. And, you know, you just, it's not when you get hurt, you know, no, if you get hurt, it's when you get hurt. So, I mean, you know it's going to happen. It's part of the game, and you got to accept it.
Do you have any other really bad injuries?
I've had probably a dozen concussions, which, you know, how that is nowadays. A lot of, you know, broken pelvis, elbow, shoulder surgery. I mean, you always break your little toes and, you know, fingers, and it's just, you're always getting banged up a lot. So, you know, you just got to try to keep going, keep that body young.
Yeah, it's funny, Chris. I have my go-to excuse ready whenever, you know, I forget someone's birthday or something like that. Well, oh, I've had too many concussions. I'm sorry.
Exactly. I use that excuse too.
But it is true. It is true.
Yeah, it is.
Something.
I had a lot of concussions.
Yeah. And do you think? I mean, do you think there's anything the industry can do as far as maybe, I know they've made great improvements with helmets, but is there anything else they can do for preventing concussions?
I don't know. Actually, the newer helmets, the styrofoam, I've seen them got knocked out more with those than the old Caliente. But they said they have proofs that they're safer. So I'm just going by their word. But I don't know if you can really, you're just going 40 miles an hour and you're getting thrown, slung down to the ground even faster. And you don't know what's going to hit you. So I don't know. They can, I'm sure this technology will get better and better, though, as the years go by.
Yeah, it's a dangerous sport, that's for sure. That's why, as I mentioned in the introduction of the show, I believe so strongly in the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. They provide financial assistance to those disabled riders. Again, visit the website, www.pdjf.org. It's a great organization, and you and I have been very lucky, Chris, and all of you, especially with all those injuries. And I read an interview you did, and obviously, you've been riding for a long time. You can't ride forever. We hope to see you in the saddle for a long time to come, but eventually you will have to retire one of these days. And do you know, is there a number in your mind as far as an age when you'll retire?
I've been pretty lucky. I still have a young body and I'm doing good and I love it. I'm hoping for another 10 years just because I just love it. And I think it's so cool and it's better than a real job is what I always tell everybody. And, once you stop, it's kind of our identity. So it's like, I like the adrenaline rush. And once you stop, I don't think you'll be able to ever come back because, you get older and your body won't work as well. So I'm going to do it till my body says, can't do it anymore.
Love it. Hey, I had Perry Utes on the show a couple weeks ago, and he's still going strong, and he's 64. So
I know. That is crazy. We were talking about him yesterday in the jocks room. I was like, how in the heck? There's no way. And he still rides. Like he's in his 20s.
Oh, yeah. It's incredible. I can't believe it.
But he's like 1% of the 1%. So,
well,
man, I don't.
That's for sure.
It's hard to keep your body going, that long. A lot of people. But it depends on how many injuries and what kind of injuries. And I think a lot of it, I see a lot of young people quit early just because of the mental impact of when you have a bad wreck. It's like a car wreck. So it's got to be mental, too, because it's hard to deal with sometimes. You can't learn to accept it and put it in the back of your head.
And how do you do that?
I think it's all, everyone has different personalities and everyone different ways of doing that. And I can just kind of like, you got to accept it and like, hey, this is going to happen. And you got to accept if you love this sport, it can go bad. And just go enjoy it while you can. That's why I try to enjoy it every day. I'm thankful for everything I get, and because you never be jealous of anybody, because you never know when's their last day. I mean, in this business or in any contact sport, something freak accidents can happen.
When you mentioned earlier how it's hard to quit because it's your identity, and I can definitely relate to that. It is weird in my mind. I'm still a jockey, but I'm not riding. So it is, it
right.
is. That's like who you are. And, it is tough, of course. I'm sure you've known riders throughout the years. You've had to retire because of one reason or another. And it is difficult to make that transition. And I know, and I wanted to talk to you briefly. We only have a couple minutes left, but you've ridden for a while, and I'm sure you've, like I said, seen people like this. In Europe, I believe they have something, a type of program for riders that transition them into kind of the real world when they are done riding. And do you think that's something needed here in the States?
Oh, definitely. And I think the last time in Las Vegas we had a Jockeys Guild meeting, that subject was brought up. Because a lot of riders like you said, that's all they know what how to do. They grew up their whole life, you know, riding horses, and then all of a sudden it's over. They can't do it anymore through injury or mentally, you know, lose their heart, I guess you could say. But we need to have something that, yes, because, you know, after 20, 30 years of riding, what do I do now? You know, they didn't get their education, like, because they've been racing, or they didn't get another skill. So we need something like that.
Yeah, I think it's very important and greatly needed, for sure. And Chris, how about you? 10 years from now, when you decide, yeah, maybe I'll hang it up, or maybe you'll ride till you're 64 like Prairie Utes. But regardless, what do you plan to do afterwards?
You know, I love horses so much. I had a trainer ask me that, Joel Burnt, last week. And he's like, you know what? I told him, I'm going to work for you. That's what I'm going to do. So, I don't know, maybe train, maybe be assistant trainer. I would like to, you know, I've always loved training. I, you know, kind of trained some horses and when I was in middle school and high school just for, you know, on the side. And I thought that was very cool. I know they all say that's really tough to make money, but I probably would try to train if I, you know, could get a couple horses and kind of like race that Bill's doing right now.
Well, Chris, we have about 30 seconds left. Really quickly, tell us, what are your goals you have for the rest of your riding career?
I think just, you know, I want to still be successful, still win. Maybe I got 10 leading rider titles, maybe get one more. Basically just have fun, and I want to enjoy it because now I'm a little older. I want to enjoy it, just enjoy that rush and have that feeling and make a difference.
Chris, we are wishing you all of the best, and thank you so much for joining us. It was great learning your story.
I had an awesome time. Thank you very much.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. While you're there, check out all of the other shows you can find here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, like Trainer Talk, Equine Forum, Express Bet Radio, and join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Don't forget our new channel, XM201. And for our producer, Lee Dallapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.